Shalom, this is Yair Davidi from New Bambi, Bitam Broadcasting Israel. We are speaking to you today concerning this week's portion, Vayishlach, and he sent, Genesis 32, verse 3 to chapter 36, inclusive, including it. This is the weekly portion on this Shabbat. This portion will be read in every synagogue in the world. This is the portion of the Torah, or the Chumash, of the first five books of the Bible written by Moses, that are divided up into sections and read out on every Shabbat, so that in the course of the year, the whole five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, commonly referred to as Chumash or as Torah, will have been read and heard by everyone who attends the synagogue on the Shabbat day. And this present portion concerns Jacob returning to the land of Israel, meeting up just before he enters the land of Israel with his brother Esau, and also what happens to him and his family once they enter the land of Israel, and the events that occur to them, and the promises that the Almighty gives to them concerning their posterity, concerning the fate, the task, and the blessings that will accrue to their descendants. This verse begins Genesis 32:3, and Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother to the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Seir is the country of Edom. Seir was the country that Esau and Edom are one of the same words. And he took over. Esau and his children took control of the land of Seir. And frequently in the Bible, the expression Seir is used as synonymous, as another name for Edom and Esau. So the word Seir was a name, a genuine name of a people, a genuine name of a country that existed before Esau, but Esau took it over. And Seir in Hebrew has several meanings. It can mean windy, a windswept area. It also can mean hairy. It's a double connotation of meaning hairy, perhaps because the hairs on one's body feel the wind. There may be other explanations, but hairs on the body apparently can convey to the body changes in temperature, changes in the air, changes in the wind. And it is ever, we often find this in the scripture. Those who are familiar with the Hebrew origin of the scripture, and especially rabbinical commentators on scripture, on the Bible, will have come across this quite often, that the name of a country, or the name of a place, or a name of a particular people, just a name or something, often reflects its destiny, often reflects what is supposed to happen to it. This is an ongoing feature of the Bible. It is an ongoing occurrence in biblical study. We find that the names of things, the names of people, the names of places reflect somehow or other the events that are destined to take place in them. And this is regardless as to why the name was originally given. Continuing with our portion, it says that he told these angels who were going up to meet Esau to tell them that he has come from Laban. Laban was their uncle, the mutual uncle. Jason, if you remember, Jacob and Esau were twins. So were twin brothers of Isaac. And Isaac was the husband of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. And Rebekah had a brother called Laban. And Jacob had gone away. He had fled from the land of Israel to the house of Laban. His mother had been afraid that his brother Esau would murder him, because Jacob had taken the blessings away from him, or at least that is how Esau saw things. So Jacob had more or less ran away, fled to his, to their mutual uncle, to Laban, and there he had married the two daughters, Rachel and Leah of Laban, and also took to wife the handmaidens of each. Altogether he had taken four women to wife in the house of Laban, and he had so far had born unto him 11 children, and later another one was to be born, he had born unto him 11 sons at least, and Dinah, a daughter, and possibly other daughters, hints to that effect, but at least the one we know by name is Dinah. And in addition to these 12 children that we know of, later on another son, Benjamin, was to be born unto him, so that would make 12 sons, and these sons were to become the forefathers of Israelite tribes. Now Jacob is returning to the land of Israel, and he is about to cross over into the land of Israel, and he is afraid that Esau would come and kill him, because Esau apparently was a warrior, he was a fighting man, he had been blessed, by your sword you shall live. He had been blessed to have military powers, he had been blessed with fighting abilities, and he is well known for this. He was a hunter, and he is well known for having this type of personality, and he was liable to come and kill not only Jacob, but also his whole family. And so Jacob was afraid, so he sent messengers unto him to tell him that he's coming to meet him. And then he sent all kinds of presents of oxen and asses and all kinds of things on before him to bring them unto Esau, so that Esau should receive these presents and perhaps be placated, perhaps not want to kill Jacob anymore. Jacob was very afraid, and he was afraid that despite everything, despite all these presents and so on that he was sending to Esau, Esau would still be angry, and Esau would kill him and possibly his whole, all his family and everyone around him. So he split them up into different groups. He split them up into two different camps. And he said, if Esau will come and kill, wipe out one, then at least the other one will remain. The other one will know about it and be able to either flee or to defend itself. At least somebody will remain alive. And this is what he did. And he prayed to God. Then he prayed to God. It says in Genesis 32:9, and Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which says unto me, return unto your country and to your kindred, and I will do well with you. He had prayed that God would help him, because God had promised him that if he comes back to the land, it would go well with him. And perhaps this is symbolic. In some ways, in many ways, what happened to the forefathers is symbolic. It teaches us what will happen. And so too we find that the Jewish people, once they had an arousing to return to the land of Israel, in the 1930s and before then, there was an arousing to return to the land of Israel, but it was stopped. And then along came the Second World War and the Holocaust, and they were wiped out. A good portion of the Jewish people, one third of the whole Jewish people, men, women and children, were massacred, were exterminated by the Gentiles who hated them. And so we see that the state of Israel just came into existence when it needed to come into existence to absorb the refugees, to return to the Jews some type of self-respect, some type of existential reality to their own psyche, to their own soul. Needed the state of Israel after such a traumatic experience, and the Almighty had given it to them and even prepared it unto them. But we see that Jacob too, even though he is coming back to the land of Israel and God had promised to be with him and help him, and this would be to its ultimate good, he realized that it was danger. Danger was in store for him. And the Jewish people, the Jews are returning to the land of Israel, and they know it's best for them. This is the best country in the world. This is the country where a Jew can keep the commandments, where a Jew can really be Jewish, where a Jew can be with his own kind, and he can do his own thing in his own culture, or return to his own culture, ultimately to return to his roots. At the same time, there's also dangers involved in this. Dangers, because as if to say that the powers of adversity are ours when they see things going too well for a person, when they see a person getting back to himself, when they see a man assert himself, demonstrate his manhood, to start to do things in the world, then all kinds of jealous eyes, all kinds of adverse feelings can be aroused against such a person. And so too amongst nations. When the nations see the Jewish people returning to the land and asserting themselves and remaking their land and returning to their forefathers, then some of them are pleased and some of them are very angry. And even those who are pleased have mixed feelings about it. And there's a certain degree of Jew hatred, of anti-Semitism, also of inferiority complexes. I don't know whatever explanation you want to give it. This is a reality. This is, the people do have negative feelings towards the Jewish people, and these negative feelings are sometimes aroused by the very existence of the State of Israel, by the very successes that the Jewish people are having. And if the Jews receive a lot of Nobel Prizes and they get on very well in business and in sciences and in teaching and in intellectual activities, so a lot of people hate them just for that. People resent it. They resent others being a little bit too clever, a little bit too smart, a little bit too successful. Even though it's not exactly true, it's not exactly that way. There are a lot of Jews who are very poor, a lot of Jews who suffer, a lot of Jews who are not very bright, not very intelligent. But in other words, the Jews are just like average people, but on the fringes, on the margins, there are more Jews which do succeed in certain fields because they set their minds to it. I grew up in Australia and I lived amongst non-Jewish people, my friends and so on, the parents of my friends, and I saw people who were experts on racehorses, experts on football, and they could tell you the lineages of certain racehorses and how they would run and how the climate would affect them, and they would make all kinds of permutations, all kinds of mathematical reckonings, all kinds of systems and theories to win a little bit of money in the betting. I don't think it was so much the idea of getting money. It was more the thrill of the chase after it in this way that seemed to fascinate a great many number of people. And this involved a great deal of intellectual activity, a great deal of emotional commitment. And it was, it exemplifies the reality that people, what people want to do, that's what they do, that's what they have set themselves for. So if the same forces, the same talents had been applied to other things, to intellectual matters and so on, so there stands the reason they would have been successful in other fields. So everyone does what they want to do, and we should not be jealous of other people, because most times other people's do not have it better than us in every way. We would not, if we knew everything, in a lot of cases we would not change positions with them. And on the whole, a person gets what he deserves, for better or for worse. And the Almighty decides what will come to us and what will come to others. So we should hold ourselves in, and we should hold ourselves back, and try and do what we have to do, and not get in the way of others, not hurt other people, not try and endanger others, not try and prevent others from getting ahead, but just do what we have to do for ourselves, for our families, to the best of our ability. And this is one of the messages we can get from the Bible. This is what Jacob is saying to Esau: do not be jealous of me. I was here, I was there, I did this and that, and God has blessed me, and now I'm coming back. And as far as I'm concerned, you can take everything I have, because it's something that was given unto me, and in the same ways it's given unto me can be taken away. But I only wish to live at peace with you. That's what Jacob said to Esau. And that was the message that Esau received. And even so, Jacob was afraid. And then so he was praying to the Almighty that the Almighty should help him. And he said, to the Almighty, said in Genesis 32:11, deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear lest he will come and smite me and the children, mother with the children. He was afraid that Esau was going to come and wipe him out, not only kill him, but kill his wives and his little ones, and leave him with nothing left on this earth. And he was praying to God, and even though God had promised him that he would protect him and help him. He did not leave it as that. He did not leave it go. He did not just take it as granted. He still prayed that the Almighty would help him. He still asked for the Almighty to be with him, for the assistance of the Almighty. He asked for mercy. He was praying. He says this, and thou says, I will surely do you good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So here too we see the Almighty had promised him that he would be the forefather of a great many people, of an extremely large number of people, of hundreds of millions of people. And that is who the Lost Ten Tribes are. That is where the Lost Ten Tribes have to be searched for. They have to be found amongst a very numerous, populous group of nations. And we have found the Lost Ten Tribes where they are. We believe the Lost Ten Tribes are amongst Western peoples, and that they have come to expression, especially through the USA and Britain and English-speaking nations. And it goes on, our portion goes on, 32:13 on, and it tells how he took goats and sheep and rams, and he sent them together, and he sent them off with the servants to take them unto Esau, and to tell Esau that these were for him. And then he took another bundle, another assemblage of gifts of livestock and of goodies. That in those days it was customary for important people to send to each other, and he sent it off. He did three of these different groups of gifts, of presents to be sent to Esau, and he sent them off separately to him. And that night he encamped by the river, and in the middle of the night he rose up and he took his two wives and his the two women servants of his wives, Bilhah and Zilpah, and the 11 sons that were with him, and they crossed over the Yabbok. The Yabbok is a river. Jabbok is how it's spelled in English. 32, Genesis 32:22. Jabbok or Yabbok in Hebrew. It's a tributary of the Jordan. And in that time, in those days, the climate was wetter, there were more trees around, there was more greenery in the land of Israel, the climate was colder, and there was more rainfall. And so if there was both having a colder climate and a greater rainfall means that the rivers would have had more water in them than they do now. And it could have been quite a river to cross over at that time. Anyway, he sent them over the brook, and he stayed on the other side, and he was left alone. And then a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day, that's what it says. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. See Genesis 32:24. He wrestled with him until the daybreak. When he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint. He wrestled with him, he struggled with him. So some people say this is a spiritual matter, this is a parable. It represents an analogy, an allegory, and this could be true. There was this aspect of this of the struggle did exist. This spiritual, symbolic aspect was there, but we also know that it happened literally. We have to take this as a general principle that Scripture always goes according to its literal meaning, unless there's something that obviates it from being so interpreted. On the whole, as far as possible, we have to understand Scripture literally. We should only take it as saying something figuratively when there's a special reason to do so, and when Scripture itself seems to indicate that it was intended in that way. Otherwise, we take things to be as they are presented. So literally speaking, Jacob did wrestle with someone, all night long. And this also shows another aspect of Jacob. We saw Jacob from the very beginning, a smooth man, it says. He was smooth of skin. He was a smooth man. He was someone who used a subterfuge, a cheater, as if to say, an imposter almost. Someone who cannot get the blessing in his own right, but has to use underhand methods to go around to get it. And even the name Jacob implies going around. And he was a favorite of his mother and not of his father. And that was one aspect of Jacob. But later we see when he sets off to go to Laban, he moves an enormous stone, a stone that normally could only be moved by a large number of men applying their strength all at once. Jacob just goes up and takes it away all on his own. Jacob shows us that there's more to him than meets the eye. Jacob is a man. Jacob has power, and we see here that Jacob, suddenly good old Jacob, little old Jacob, is wrestling, is physically engaged in struggle. He is wrestling, fighting away with some unknown being all night long until the daybreak. And then this being wants to go and Jacob won't let him. But the being, as it says in Genesis 32:25, touched him on the hollow of his thigh. Now take this hollow of his thigh to be an euphemism. It suggests sex, something connected with sex. So often the Israelites and the Jewish people have fallen down because of their sexual weaknesses, because of giving into sexual temptation. And even the rabbis, the sages in the Talmud said there is no guarantee in sexual matters. No one is immune from sexual temptation. No one can be certain of himself, and no one should be certain of themselves. They shouldn't, one put, should not put oneself into temptation. One should not play around with these things. This is a basic instinct of a human being. This is an urgent pull, something the Almighty has placed within us. And it will be with us all the days of our life. And we want it that way. It gives us the ability to express who we are. At the same time, there are all kinds of laws and inhibitions and prohibitions connected to it that the Bible speaks to us about that we have to keep regarding it. And so each one of us has his own way, his own method of coping with this aspect of their existence, or not coping with it, as the case may be. But each one of us should know what it entails, what is entailed in this. And we are told that, on the whole, this would be a weakness of the Israelite peoples, that they would have a tendency somehow or other to give in to their own more basic emotions, more basic drives when the matter of sex or sexual attraction is concerned. And anyway, even though he was touched in that area, and we will see later, he was limped ever afterwards. He went away limping. It hurt physically. It hurt him. Even so, he kept on. He held the person. He would not let him go until he gave him a blessing. And he said unto him, as in Genesis 32:27, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name could be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince has thou power with God and with men, it has prevailed." And so that was the incident with the angel. He's wrestling with the angel, and he continued. The next day he was limping because of it, and ever since, there's certain sinew in the thigh of animals that religious Jews do not eat, because as it says here, and you see in Genesis 32:32, "There are for the children of Israel eat not of the sinew that shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh until this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew that shrank." And then he lifted up his head in Genesis 33:1, and he lifted up his head, and behold, Esau came with him 400 men. And so Jacob divides the children up, and he puts Joseph hindermost, it says in Genesis 33:2, "And he put the handmaids and the children foremost, and Leah and the children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindmost. And even now we see the division of the Israelite peoples, those people we identify as belonging to the lost tribes of Israel, as our research shows, and those who are interested can go to our website, www.britam.org, and there you will find a commentary that this present talk is based upon, a written commentary with more ideas, with more elaborate explanations that go with more detail into some of the points we have raised. And you will also find other articles, more than 1,000 articles, 1,500 plus articles and notes and so on, and pieces of genuinely valuable information that you may not find anywhere else concerning the Lost Ten Tribes, especially concerning the Lost Ten Tribes, because that's what we are concentrating upon, but also in general biblical knowledge and general knowledge of the world, and general knowledge of the peoples we are concerned with and the people that we believe in. So Jacob did this, and he came unto his brother, and Esau went up and met him, embraced him, and fell upon his neck, and they wept. And then Esau said, who are these? He lifted up and says, all the women and the children. And Jacob says, they're the wives and the children that God has benefited me with. And they all bow down. And Esau wants him to come with him to a certain length of the journey. But Jacob refuses, saying he has the children and he has little ones, and people haven't got that much strength. And if they go with Esau and try and keep up with him, they're liable to damage themselves. They're liable to cause damage to themselves and great inconvenience and also physical upset. And therefore he declines to go, but he says that you go on alone, and with God willing, I will come to meet you in your land. So the sages said he was prophesying that he would come to meet him, that in the end days Joseph, the descendant of Jacob, would go up unto Edom and fight against it. And he went on, and he built a place, and he went built an altar in the area of Sukkot. And he kept going, and he came to Shechem. And Shechem was a city. And Shechem was also the name of the mayor, of the ruler of that city. Or rather, he was the name of the prince whose father, Hamor, ruled the city. And Hamor was the name of the ruler. And Hamor in Hebrew means donkey. Now, a donkey, we always consider donkeys to be stupid. And maybe they are, but usually they're just stubborn. Donkeys also can exhibit a great deal of intelligence. But they're stubborn, and they don't always obey you. And sometimes they have minds of their own. And they are liable to resist being directed, even when this is liable to cause them inconvenience, to cause them pain and danger. And that could be where you get the idea that donkeys are stupid from that type of behavior. But donkeys also have positive qualities. A male donkey has strength, stamina, persistence, virility, intelligence, and individuality. A male donkey is something. A donkey is something in its own right. A good donkey is something that to be valued, or at least it was before the time of the motor car. So this person was named Hamor, and his son was named Shechem, and they ruled over the local area. They ruled over the city of Shechem. And there Jacob set up an altar. And then it happened that Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, went out. She went out to, as girls go out, as young women go out, to visit the local maidens, to visit the local girls. And Shechem, the son of Hamor, and the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, took her and lay with her, and he defiled her. He took her, raped her, and he did bad things unto her, as it says in Genesis 34:2. And then he fell in love with her, as sometimes happens, that rapists and whatever fall in love with their victim. And he spoke kindly unto her, and it may be that she was suffering from some type of Stockholm syndrome, because that is what happens. This is a famous case in Sweden, where a group of bandits tried to rob a bank, and they took hostages in the bank's vault. And some of the hostages began to sympathize with them, and even some of the young girls amongst the hostages fell in love with the bank robbers. This is called the Stockholm Syndrome, because the most famous case of it took place in Stockholm. But Stockholm is not the only place where this happens. It happens all over the world, and sometimes the victim identifies with the victimizer. This is a quirk of human nature, but it is a known phenomenon, and maybe all of us have something of this propensity or inclination or liability to be afflicted with the Stockholm syndrome. And so anyway, Shechem decided he wanted to marry the girl. He spoke well unto her. Then he went and spoke to his father, saying, let me take this damsel to wife. And he wanted to marry her. And incidentally, there are primitive societies, both amongst white people, for instance, in areas of the Caucasus and elsewhere, and dark people amongst different wild groups in Asia, where it is accepted for the male, lusty young male, to go and take a woman, to even abduct a woman, to even rape her, and then compensate the family, get everything set up, get everything legalized afterwards. And that was what Hamor was doing. And that was accepted amongst the people of the city. But for the children of Israel, this was a bad thing. It was an evil way to act. It was bad enough that they would act that way amongst themselves, but that they would try and force this pattern of behavior upon the sons of Jacob, upon the whole clan of Jacob, was something that could not be forgiven. It was something that could not be overlooked. It was something that needed to be punished for their own sake of self-preservation. So that explains the later actions, as we shall see, of the sons of Jacob, of how they reacted to the rape of Dinah. We will continue shortly in the second part of the speech of this little talk concerning the weekly portion of the Bible. We will continue quite soon. And we will tell you what happened and more important things connected with this week's portion. This is Yair Davidi from New Bambi, Britain, broadcasting Israel. Thank you.